Hi, everyone. Good morning. Nice big crowd on this cold morning. And I'm happy to be here. I've been kind of contemplating a couple topics in the past week and a half, and one of them is ancestors. You know, the role of ancestors in our tradition, and the reason that we're here today in this moment, sharing this moment, is because of the efforts of our ancestors. So that's our ancestor Katagiri and Suzuki, our ancestor Dogen, our ancestor Bodhidharma, and the big guy Shakyamuni. So I've been thinking about that, and thinking about how they paved the way for us so that we can practice the Dharma today in our own style, our family style here at Zen Center and down at Hokyoji. The stories of these ancestors are really interesting, and the story of Shakyamuni, probably you've all heard it 100 times, except for those of you who are new to Zen and new to Buddhism. But I kind of wanted to review the story of Shakyamuni this morning as kind of a hero's quest, because we all have a hero's quest. We're all the hero and the heroine of our own story and our own quest. So when I've been thinking about the ancestors and about Shakyamuni, I've been thinking about also about sickness and health. And as you know, Shakyamuni discovered some things about the human condition. The story is he was a pampered prince living in a palace, although now that story is being revised. Yeah. Now we still like that story. That's a great story, to think of him as this pampered prince in a palace, you know, but he's actually a member of a clan, the Shakya clan. And I don't think he was a prince in the way that we think of princes and princesses and fairy stories. And I think their lives were pretty tough. But relatively speaking, he was privileged, and he was. There was a prophecy about him that he would either become a great king, a great leader, or a great sage, a great spiritual being. And when his father found out about the dual prophecy, he wanted to guide things in the way of his being a king. He wanted to protect the family from the prophecy of a great spiritual leader. So the story goes that he was protected from everything that indicated what real human life was about. And apparently at some point he got bored with his life, and he felt, you know, a restlessness and a dissatisfaction, and he went over the wall of the compound. That's how the story goes. And when he went over the wall, he encountered a sick person, an old person, and a corpse. And I think a holy man too, right? A sadhu, a holy man. And he was with his driver at the time, apparently, and he said, "What is this? What's going on?" You know, and the driver explained, "Well, this is what happens to all of us." And the Buddha said, "You mean even me?" And Gautama said, and the driver said, "Yes, even you, even me, even you." So just imagine, you know, imagine that you don't live in the information age, and you live in some primitive time, and you're hearing this story for the first time. And let's say you're an adolescent, you know, and we're all raised on lots of stories. But now we're just inundated with stories, right? So story has lost some of its potency for us. But because we hear too much, but imagine that you live in a simpler time and you hear this story about Gautama's big shock. He has this big shock when he finds out what's really going on in the world with human beings. And imagine it's not just the shock of the fact that he's going to die and everyone he loves is going to die and that he's going to age and that he's going to get sick. But also simultaneously this awareness that this had been hidden from him. You know, it had been concealed by his family. Imagine that. So a dual shock, you know. Here's this shocking reality, and then there's the realization that he's kind of been deceived, you know, all this time. So then I'd like you to think back to the time when you were a young child, and you were a young child, and think about, if you can, the first time you heard that you were going to die, and that your parents were going to die, and that your grandparents were going to die, and that your cat was going to die, and your dog. And maybe try to remember what that was like for you. So in thinking about Buddha's story, I reflected on my story, and on being a child, maybe 8, maybe 9, and for me, I remember being very disturbed by this, hearing about this fact of life, about our mortality, our human condition, and I recall just, you know, ruminating about it inside and wondering and being afraid and trying to come to terms with it. Noticing that the grown-ups didn't seem to want to talk about it at all. And in fact, that's what made it even more difficult, was the fact that they didn't talk about it. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to go there. And so we can kind of live into Buddha's story more when we think about it that way. Think about life and death and those moments when we're young. And so the story goes, he goes back to the to his home, and he vows to leave and go on a quest to find out if there's anything beyond this life. Not only this life of being asleep and distracted and a life with comforts, but also this reality of the human condition that he's discovered. He wants to find out if there's something beyond that. So he leaves, and this is the part a lot of people have trouble with. You know, you picture him going in and looking, gazing at his wife and his child, his infant child, and maybe he gazes longingly at them, maybe he has a tear, I don't know. The stories don't really say that. You have to imagine that too. But he decides to leave, that this is so important. It's such a burning question in his mind that he leaves. He leaves that life. And he goes out and he wanders. And he searches for teachers. And he studies with the sadhus of the time, the holy men who wear very little and have matted hair. And he does all kinds of practices, ascetic practices. He eats very little, does all these yoga postures. He sits in charnel grounds and sits in the forest around wild animals. And he still doesn't figure it out. He doesn't find what he's looking for. So then the story goes that he's become very weak from all these practices. And he's discouraged, and he's sitting out in the open, and a goat girl comes up, and she sees that he's in not a very good state. Maybe she's thinking, Well, I don't know. You're not making that meditation look too attractive to me, you know. So she brings him a cup of milk and offers it to him. Says, please, sir, you know, take this. And so he does. Maybe it's the purity of her offering. Maybe he thinks, well, what have I got to lose? This isn't working. But he takes nourishment. And he revives somewhat. And he has more energy. And he actually reflects then on a time in his life when he was young. And he had an experience of awakening that was joyful. It didn't involve self-sacrifice. The story goes, he was sitting under a tree at the plowing festival, and he just had a spontaneous experience of being one with all of life in his immediate surroundings, and he had great compassion for the insects and the little creatures that were displaced from the plowing. It was a beautiful experience for him. Actually, it was a joyful experience. And he'd forgotten all about it. But he recalled it there after he took that nourishment. And he vowed to sit there until he finally broke through all of his delusion, all of his fears and worries, concerns. All of that came to him, and he sat through it all, but he sat through it with new insight and new energy, and he nurtured the self so that he could drop the self and wake up. And because of his experience, all the other ancestors, the Chinese ancestors and the Japanese ancestors and our American ancestors, were able to do this practice and pass it down to us. So he was disillusioned. He started with disillusionment, and he went out on a quest, and he went through all kinds of things, and he came back to a balance. And afterwards he preached the middle way between extremes, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So in the Lotus Sutra, which I haven't read much of, but Dogen Zenji, our Japanese Soto Zen ancestor, really revered the Lotus Sutra, and I guess Tigan Layton has a book out on it, and I'd like to get that. But there is a story I've heard from it that it's actually a quotation that goes, how do you know a ninth stage bodhisattva is really a ninth stage bodhisattva? And the answer is, because the ninth stage bodhisattva understands his or her responsibility to experience and help other people experience joy. So we're just everyday bodhisattvas here. We're just everyday mind is the way MZMC, Hokyoji, bodhisattvas, not ninth stage, but I think we can benefit from the practice of cultivating balance in Zen practice. So down at Hokyoji where I live, we've been in practice period for the last week. There's 4 weeks of practice period there, and it's kind of a real immersion type of practice period. It's 4 weeks, and it's residential, and there's a lot of sitting, and there's some study, and some eating, and walking, and using the bathroom, and stretching, and it's all practice, all those practices. And we're looking at a koan, and so I've also been contemplating this case from the records, the koan records, cases. And it's case 94. The book is Serenity. It's called Dongshan's Illness. So I will read this to you. I'll read the case and then say a few things about it. And I want to say, Tim asked me this morning upstairs, he said, "Well, how are you? How are you feeling?" And I said, "Oh, fine. Good. I'm well." And then I thought, after he left, how ironic. Today's talk is about sickness and health, wellness and illness, and practicing with both. So, this case, Dongshan was one of the co-founders of our school of Soto Zen called Kaodong in the golden age of Zen in the Tang Dynasty. And he was one of these guys that legends have been made of, you know. And so I want to say a little bit about koans in Soto Zen. We're oftentimes when you open a book of koans for the first time and you read some of these things, they don't make any sense at all. And you just say, "Oh, shit." Excuse me. You just say, "Oh, no," you know. "Oh, no, I don't understand this at all. This makes no sense to me, and I hope there's not a test on it." You know, I remember feeling really anxious the first time I opened up a book of these, and we were studying them here since years ago. They don't make sense, a whole lot of sense, in a conventional way. But they point to something that is very true and is very real. And my experience has been that if I read a koan, I read it with other people and I study it, and then I just bring it into my meditation, my zazen, that it begins to kind of open up, you know, and it's worth the effort. It's worth the investigation to look at them. So here's the case. When Dongshan was unwell, a monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dongshan said, "There is." Okay, so this is already different from what Buddha discovered, right? The monk said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" The monk said, "Does the one who's not ill look after you?" Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk said, How is it when you look after him?" And Dongshan said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." So, usually we think of the person who's ill as being cared for by the one who's not ill, right? Because the one who's not ill has the capacity to take care of the one who's ill. That's the usual way we look at this. And I think that makes some sense. But what Dongshan is saying is a little different. It turns conventional wisdom on its head. The way we usually look at illness when we become ill is, sometimes we just power through it. We just keep going because we're too busy and we have an important job to do and we just don't have time to be ill. So that's one way, and that can work for a while. And another way that people often cope with being ill is to just sort of ruminate on it and think about it. And, you know, it's very fear-based underneath all this thinking and strategizing for how to get on top of it and kind of get some distance from it is fear. You know, it's basically that we're afraid. And I have had the experience before of being quite ill. I remember when my children were very young, I had an infant and I had a toddler, and I became ill. I became exhausted, and I had trouble getting out of the bed. I had trouble caring for these two very young beings, and I felt helpless. I felt overwhelmed. It was just difficult. It was like being the snake in the bamboo tube. That's kind of Gary Roshi used to say, being the snake in the bamboo tube. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing you can really do in that situation, but try to meet it moment by moment. And so I did, and it took, you know, I learned everything I could about helping my immune system. It was an immune system problem, and I went to doctors and chiropractors, and I changed my diet, and eventually I got better. So I did do some things, and they were important things to do. And after about a year, it took about a year before I would say that I felt well, relatively speaking. It was a minimum of a year, I'm sure. And after that, I remember if I came down with a cold or I got a flu, you know, I caught a bug, I would become terrified. I would just really get scared. And that was a reaction I had, you know, to oh no, it's back. What's going to happen? You know, is this it again? You know, and it took me a while to trust that this was just a cold. This was just a flu, you know, and just to meet it, meet the experience. So that's pretty common, you know. That reaction to being ill. But this koan says there's a way for us to practice when we're ill. You probably all know that if you've been in pain before, the more you resist the pain, the worse it gets. So the more you resist it, the worse it gets. So that's what we discover. And that's a really good thing to discover. It's actually really empowering. Because when we figure out that non-resistance is the way, sure, we take something for our pain, but when that something doesn't work, what do we do then? You know, just by being with it, just like we are when we're with our thoughts in Zazen, you know, and our feelings that come up when we're with our physical pain and we just focus on the sensation itself. At a certain point, there is an easing. If not of the actual physical pain, of the mental pain we're putting ourselves through in resisting the physical pain. So this monk asks, so this learning how to deal with pain and learning how to deal with illness is a great practice for living this life, you know, for interacting with others who are ill and for aging and facing our death someday. So the monk asked a really good question, and you can tell he kind of knew the answer by the way he asked it, or he had a glimmer. He wasn't completely in the dark, because he says, does the one who is not ill look after you? So he kind of has an idea about this. And Dongshan says, kind of confirms this idea. He says, I have the opportunity to look after him. And then the monk wants to know. He wants the whole. So he says, how is it when you look after him? How is it? And then Dongshan says, then I don't see that he has any illness. So, Dongshan's talking about himself in this case. He's talking about himself. He's talking about the ill self. And he's not just ill in this case. The background is he is dying, actually. He's dying, and the monks all come to his room to inquire about his health, and they're all pretty young. And they're asking, you know, how are you, Master? But at the same time, they're turning away. You know, they're really not present for his answer or for his teaching of how he's actually dealing with his situation. So they're really not there, except for this monk who gets it a little bit, you know, and who draws out this response, this very unconventional view that Dongshan has about his illness. He's totally practicing with that illness. With total devotion, he has no choice. Right? And so, in that process, he discovers the being within the being that's sick, who is not ill. So it's interesting that so often when we approach somebody who is ill, we kind of approach them with maybe a little residue of pity, you know, and we see ourselves as we're the well one and they're the sick one, and we have something to offer them because we're well and we are well-meaning and we, you know, want to do something good, want to do something nice. And so we so often approach with this delusion. Really, basically, it's a delusion that we are the well one and they are the ill one. I remember Katagiri saying years ago, back in those late 70s or early 80s, he said, you're never 100% healthy. You're never 100% healthy. You always have some cancer cells in you. You're always, you know, there is some illness in you. And I think he may have been stressing this because we were all so gung-ho about being healthy and eating in the right diets and exercising and doing yoga and being the best that we could be and completely eradicating any illness and, you know, being super Zen students, you know. And basically he was saying, sorry, you know, that's just not the way it is, you know. That's, you're never really completely well. And so it would follow that we're never really completely and totally sick, wouldn't it? Anyway, I remember being impressed by that, you know, and thinking, wow, could that be true? You know, that we're not ever completely 100% healthy. But it's interesting, I can recall it now in looking at this, and I'm happy that he helped us to see things a little bit more clearly in that way. Here's the commentary. When the ancients were about to go, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness and death. Among them, Dongshan is unusual. Once he manifested a slight illness. Everyone came to look in on him. One monk asked, "You are ill, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" So I think it's helpful to do this practice for a while before one gets seriously ill. I think that could certainly help. And Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi and Aitken, Robert Aitken, and many other Zen teachers showed us how that could look. When a person who's practiced for years and who's really gone deep gets sick and dies, what that can look like, you know, and how little fear is there, you know, and how little, if any, none really self-pity can be found in those folks. And it's inspiring. very inspiring. One of his students said, Suzuki Roshi said, near the end of his life, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, both are good, and there's no Buddha. And if I'm suffering, it's all right, I'm suffering Buddha. And so he completely accepted it. Now for one of those crazy stories. Here's a verse, Dongshan's verse. Though the students are many, not one is enlightened. The mistake lies in pursuing the paths of others' tongues. If you want to be able to forget physical form and obliterate tracks, residue, karma, karmic residue, work hard to diligently walk in the void. And when he finished the verse, he shaved his head and sounded the bell. Sitting in the hall, he said goodbye to the assembly, and he passed away. They wailed with guilt, with grief. It says he appeared to die. He isn't actually saved, passed away. He appeared to die. They wailed with grief. He opened his eyes and had a meal for stupidity prepared. A feast for the assembly, and extended his life for 7 more days. After which he again bade farewell to the community and then passed away for real this time. So there has to be some humor here, right? And I think that these stories are pretty funny, and if he really did that, I would have liked to have been there. That would have really made my day, my month, my year, probably my entire life, if I'd been able to witness that. So we present what we're interested in, and this is an interest of mine. And my friend told me last night about her encounter with a chaplain, where the chaplain was rather condescending, and I felt badly about that. And I just realized that if I go in to see a patient with an attitude that I'm well and they're sick, poor them, poor little thing, it's not helpful. It's not at all helpful, you know. And I just want to be of help. So if I'm asked, so. So what I can do is just to be present with my very imperfect, partially sick, partially well self, and to bear witness and keep my heart open and try to be vulnerable and try to have a brave heart and keep practicing, keep doing the practice of sitting and looking and reflecting and letting go. And I invite you to do that as well, and to come here and get support for that. And it does take effort. It's not always joyful. It's not always a warm bath or relaxing, and it's not stress reduction, it's not self-improvement, but it's a very satisfying practice and way to live. That's it. To your health. A toast to your health.
Question of health and illness, I've read that if you look at the, first of all, there is our conscious mind that imagines that it's directing our lives. If you look at the genetic material in the human body, my body, your body, well over half of it belongs not to the human genome, but to the bacteria and the viruses and the parasites that live within the body, and of course that are constantly interacting with the human part of us. I thought that was interesting. The second thing, I guess, I wanted to say was this decision of the Buddha to leave his family. It just, as you were telling the story, I realized, well, I think there are probably points in everyone's life where one reaches this sort of situation. And for my part, what I've discovered is there isn't a decision. It's a recognition. It's a recognition that the life that one was leading can't continue.
No longer works, yeah.
No longer works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's helpful to keep that in mind. I think it's, when I had young children, I had a harder time with this story, you know, the defining story of Buddhism, you know, of leaving home and leaving behind, you know, a wife and child. It was very difficult, you know, and I'm able, what you're saying sheds more light, and it's true, yeah. It's not always, it isn't really always a choice, a clear choice between one thing and the next. And it is, you know, I like to think of it as the hero's quest, and we're all the authors of our quest, our stories, you know.
You say something about what life is like in a Zen monastery, kind of like setting the day.
Okay.
In the Midwest.
Okay. Well, it's really monastic inspired. It's not, technically speaking, a monastery as Ramanji Monastery is, but it is monastically inspired, and so. A friend of mine is down there right now doing her shuso. She's the head monk of a 4-week practice period, and she was visiting Tomoe Katagiri, and Tomoe said, "So when you get down there, there's really no escape." And I think, you know, and it sounds funny, but I think she meant that in a good way. I mean that's an opportunity. Just like Dongshan has the opportunity to look after the one who's not ill, when there's no escape, that's a great opportunity. Because the rest of the time we just live with constant choice, and it's so easy to escape. And so it's really a great opportunity, and it's a good thing. So there's that element to it, that it's intense, and of course, you could get in your car and drive away, you know, but in a sense, it's an opportunity to experience no escape, just going deeply, just, and the everyday routine is very simple. It's just very simple. Like I was saying, just the hours are kind of early, getting up at 4, and, you know, for not everybody, the ones in the residence can get up at 4... 15? 30. Yeah, but we have to come over from our yurt where we live, and so we have to get there, so it takes us a little longer. So it's there's not enough sleep, and you're in a close quarters at Hokkyoji with other people, and that's another aspect of it that's challenging. Is that you are with, and it's a small group there of residents, and you know, there is no escape. So we just have to work things out that come up, and things do come up. things do come up. And so that if there's a challenge in that way, and there's also great benefits to practicing in a very wild, natural environment. It's quite beautiful, and it's helpful to one's sitting practice to sit in close to nature like that. Mm-hmm. We are experimenting with some down there with some forms that are with our daily residential practice now. Instead of two sits in the morning, very early, we're sitting starting at 6:30, which is fashionably late by Zen standards, and we're also doing one sit and then doing a half an hour of stretching together. So we're caring for our bodies. We've made a conscious intention to take care of our bodies. So sort of the daily 5 day a week practice is three sits a day and the stretching and a service in the morning and then Oreoke breakfast together. And if one of us has to work or go off and do something, then we just don't participate. But in general, that's what we try to do together in a semi-communal kind of way, and it's a great opportunity. Yeah. Is that good? Okay. Okay.
One last follow-up question: to what extent is a place like that open for visitors?
Oh. Well, we have formal practice opportunities, and we have a website. Just like everybody nowadays, and you can go in there and see what those opportunities are. The practice periods, the winter practice period is really mainly for more experienced practitioners. Or you can get a letter from your teacher saying that you're good to go with the intensity of it. But we also have open times. We've got a community weekend coming up this year. And we have some times when there's nothing on the schedule where, you know, we definitely... we always welcome visitors, even if there is some formal practice going on. We always welcome visitors, so... Yeah. So that's it. Thank you.